Welcome to the second episode in my mini-series on Indian politics to mark the Indian elections. In episode one, we looked at the history of Hindu nationalism in India. And in this episode, I'm focusing on the question of democracy. Specifically, whether the enormous election currently taking place in India is enough for us to deem the country properly democratic. That's certainly an image of India that Narendra Modi wants to project onto the world stage. And at this year's Summit of Democracy, he said this.
Consensus building, open dialogue, and free discussion have resonated throughout India's history. That is why my fellow citizens consider India to be the mother of democracy.
That idea that India is the mother of democracy might be historically disputed, but it's a narrative that many world leaders have been happy to go along with. The Summit of Democracy at which Modi was speaking at is in fact a recent creation of the United States, and Joe Biden has sought to use the distinction between democracy and autocracy as a means to isolate China.
One of the fundamental reasons that I believe the U.S.-China relationship is not in the space it is in with the U.S.-Indian relationship is that there's an overwhelming respect for each other because we're both democracies.
But within India, opposition leaders have questioned whether Modi's India is genuinely democratic. In February this year, India's main opposition party called Congress had its bank accounts frozen. The purported reason related to allegations of tax evasion, but the timing, just 2 months before a general election, was, to say the least, deeply suspicious. And as Congress leader Rahul Gandhi explained in a press conference last month, the controversial move provoked little pushback from the institutions supposedly tasked with safeguarding India's democracy.
What's interesting to me is that there are institutions in this country that are supposed to protect the democratic framework. There are the courts in the country. There's the election commission in the country. Right? And nothing is happening. The election commission has not even said, wait a minute, you have frozen the bank account of the largest, of one of the biggest political parties, largest opposition in the country. And already, our ability to fight the election has been damaged. We've already lost a month. As Markanji said, we are unable to get slots for advertising. We are unable to put ads in newspapers. And so what sort of a democracy is this?
Smaller parties than Congress have also been targeted in this pre-election crackdown. In March, the chief minister of Delhi and founder of the Common Man's Party was put under arrest.
Something unprecedented has happened in India. A sitting chief minister has been arrested. You're talking about Arvind Kejriwal. He heads the government in Delhi. He also leads the Aam Aadmi Party. It's one of the six national parties recognized by the Election Commission of India. So he's an important political player. And as expected, there is backlash.
The arrest of Arvind Kejriwal was ostensibly related to allegations of corruption. But as historian and my guest last week, Pratnav Anil, has written in Unheard, quote, everyone sees the ruse for what it is, a means to destroy the common man's party, which has long been a burr in the ruling BJP's saddle. My guest on today's show has offered the definitive account of another set of arrests that are indicative of the erosion of India's democracy. The Incarcerations by Alper Shah describes the arrest of 16 high-profile intellectuals, lawyers, journalists and labour organisers. The 16 were accused of being part of a plot to assassinate Narendra Modi, and they were accused of being urban terrorists. These were ludicrous charges, but India's compliant press and judiciary went along with them. In the cover quote of Alper Shah's book, the renowned essayist Pankaj Mishra writes that, quote, no finer account has been written yet about the collapse of the world's largest democracy. Alper Shah is currently Professor of Anthropology at the London School of Economics, and in the next academic year will begin a new role as Professor of Social Anthropology at the University of Oxford. Alpa Shah, thank you so much for joining me on Crash Course.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
And I want to start with, I suppose, a big question. In what ways is India democratic, and in what ways is it not?
Well, it depends how you define democracy, right? It's the world's largest electoral democracy. We are recording in the middle of almost a billion voters going to the polling stations, eligible to go to the polling stations. It's expected that there's going to be high voter turnout, certainly better than here in the UK. And in that sense, as an electoral exercise, I like to call it the ritual of elections, you know, India appears to be democratic. However, if you think about what democracy means, and if you go to, you know, the ancient ideas of democracy, which have been kept alive through the ages, if you define democracy as Erica Benner in her wonderful little book, Adventures in Democracy, has recently done, as the sharing of power, and not just political power, but also economic power and cultural power, then democracy is a serious question mark in India, to say the very least. India is one of the most unequal countries in the world. Inequality has just risen astronomically in the last few decades, especially since 1991. And in terms of political sharing of power, there has been the huge repression of dissent, any form of opposition to the repression and silencing and incarceration of those who have been fighting for democracy on the ground in faraway parts of the corners of the country, for the most marginalized communities, and who have been doing so for decades, who have defined democracy as being about the economic sharing of power, who have been questioning the huge inequalities that we have seen rising in India, and who have a long tradition of working with social movements on the ground, and many of whom have been just simply incarcerated. So I think what we see happening in India right now is the ritual of elections. And in terms of democracy, I think that is really under question. And people all over the world have been questioning this, you know, the Financial Times, which is, you know, a very kind of moderate paper, has been calling India an authoritarian. You're seeing the rise of authoritarianism in India. The VDEM Institute, which is this institute in Sweden, which measures democracy worldwide and has kind of quite robust mechanisms to do so, has shown that India is an electoral autocracy, has, you know, really declined in the last few years. Even The Economist has said that India is sleepwalking into authoritarianism. So, yeah, maybe we can talk more about, you know, what that actually means on the ground. But I think whether India is democratic is completely up for questioning.
And in terms of what that does mean on the ground, and I suppose what you mean by ritualistic democracy. So I suppose, as far as I understand it, the votes will be counted and they'll be counted properly. And as you say, the turnout rate in India tends to be higher than in countries like the UK. So there's presumably some sort of enthusiasm for this election, because people aren't correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think there are sort of gangs bullying people to go to the polls and telling them who to vote for. So people sort of are by free choice going out, and lots of them will by free choice vote for Modi, and their votes will be counted properly. So in that sense, it is democratic. And but the reason why so many people, yourself included, sort of are calling it potentially an electoral autocracy is because the playing field is so skewed that it can't be considered necessarily a free and fair election. Is that correct?
I think there's a real questioning, I mean, of whether the election is going to be free and fair, and rightly so. The ruling party has jailed chief ministers of state, two chief ministers of state, have been put in jail. Meanwhile, the BJP has gained, which is the party that's expected to win, has had this mechanism called electoral bonds instituted in 2017, which have given it huge sums of anonymous donations, which have now been declared unconstitutional, but which is, you know, in a way too late. So it's expected that this is going to be the world's most expensive election, and the BJP has benefited far more than any other party through this electoral bond mechanism, which has enabled all the donations for their campaigns. So I think those are some of the reasons why people are questioning whether this is a free and fair election. When I used to do field work in the forests in India back in the late 1990s, early 2000s, you would have people would just literally take the voting box, you know, there was put your vote, and they just take it and they run away with it, you know, and they kind of completely cook it up, you know, so that, of course, in the same way as today with all the kind of new technologies. But there have been questions raised also about those technologies and the ways that they will work, and whether the Election Commission. So there are questions about the process of voting itself at the moment, yeah.
And because as far as I understand it, there isn't much faith in the Electoral Commission by opposition parties. So I know Rahul Gandhi from the Congress has sort of really complained that they got their bank accounts frozen and there wasn't any pushback from any of the sort of government institutions which are supposed to protect electoral integrity. So I suppose that background might mean that they're not going to have full faith in these voting machines, potentially.
Right, exactly. Yes, yeah.
These arrests, could you talk a bit more about the context of them? So I've only really read up on the chief minister of Delhi, so the founder of the Common Man Party, and I know that he was put under arrest for allegations that he'd sort of taken part in a liquor scam. So I think in Delhi the state makes quite a lot of money by either selling liquor or by selling licenses to sell liquor to private firms, and the claim is that he was getting loads of kickbacks, and therefore, just by coincidence, they happened to have to arrest him 2 months before a general election, which the timing is incredibly suspicious. I don't think anyone will deny that. But I mean, what is the background here? Is it the case that lots of politicians are somewhat corrupt, so you can kind of pick and choose who to arrest when you want? Or is it that they're just completely trumped up charges?
Well, I mean, corruption has been a long-standing problem of the Indian political system from, you know, decades and decades ago. I mean, I don't know about the particular ins and outs of exactly what Kejriwal has, you know, who's the chief minister who's in prison, has done or not, but he denies those charges that have been laid against him. I think what's interesting here is the ways in which incarceration is being used to silence the opposition just before the elections, but also how the incarceration has been used as a means of silencing so many dissenters across the country, whether it's journalists, whether it's students, whether it's, you know, democratic rights activists, human rights defenders. And then, you know, there's a number of mechanisms that are used. There's also been the whole allegations of money laundering, and, you know, suddenly you have the tax authorities that you're knocking on your door, and then they say, you know, there's charges against you and you have to basically close shop. That's happened to 16,500 plus probably NGOs. You know, in recent years, and these are non-government organizations who have been, you know, critical of the ruling party, but also, you know, just politics more, you know, political parties more generally, who are doing, you know, extraordinary work on the ground, but who've been getting foreign funding for it, and Modi's used these kind of tax authorities to just come down and close down all forms of dissent. I mean, the BBC have had, you know, tax raids on their offices. They did this absolutely brilliant documentary called Modi's India, and that was broadcast, I think it was a couple of years ago, maybe even last year, which showed how Modi was complicit in riots in the state of Gujarat when he was chief minister in 2002, in which, you know, more than 1,000 Muslims were, you know, really barbarically murdered by Hindus, and the police just kind of watched on, and the chief minister appeared to do nothing, or allowed everybody to watch on. And this is reported by many journalists across India, but the BBC also uncovered a report by our Foreign Office, the UK Foreign Office, which also showed the same things. And so this documentary was basically silenced. It was banned in India. You couldn't screen it. You couldn't put it on social media. And those who did so were jailed, or, you know, and the BBC then had, after that, you know, had the tax authorities on their doorstep, you know, and had to, and a case, a lawsuit against the producers of that documentary, and now have basically had to more or less close down shop as they existed in India, outsourcing now to a kind of, or making a kind of private company, which hasn't really happened in the BBC's history, you know. And so this kind of use of where they can, the tax authorities have been used to come down and clamp down on any form of dissent, but where they can't, or where, you know, incarceration might be more powerful, that's the method that's been used. Yeah, of course, in the far corners of the country, with people who have no voice outside those areas, there's also been much more brutal forms of silencing going on, lynching, assassination, you know, killing. I mean, these are all weapons of the powerful in silencing dissent.
Yeah, and so in terms of sort of incarcerations and lynchings, we'll sort of go into that in more detail when we get to your brilliant new book. I thought that was very useful, sort of that context with the BBC, actually. So sort of in preparation for this mini-series, I watched both episodes of the Modi Question, very good BBC documentary. And, you know, the fact that they then went after the BBC for tax reasons does make it seem as if these aren't particularly neutral tax authorities that have gone and closed Congress's accounts 2 months before the election. Before we get on to your book and sort of the
there have been a number of cases, you know, in which suddenly, you know, the people who have been raided or who've had charges against them join the BJP, and then those charges are dropped.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So it's very transparent. Which actually leads to my next question, because if this is transparent, obviously, if you were in a country with a free media critical of the government, they'd be jumping on all of these stories. You know, we spend a lot of time in my other job on Navarra Media criticizing the British press, but I do imagine that if the Tories decided to shut down the Labour Party's accounts 2 months before an election on trumped up sort of tax fraud charge rage in the press, they would talk about it a lot. As far as I understand it, the Indian media is much more happy to go along with everything that Modi's doing. Am I correct in that assumption?
Yeah, I think like we have a lot of the small independent outlets here, the same in India. There are some amazing journalists and amazing people who are doing cutting edge stories, who are putting their lives on the line, who are getting arrested, who are against all odds producing stories that really matter, that are telling the truth, that are exposing the lies. But the mainstream media has been, although there are, you know, there are really hundreds of thousands, well, 100,000, I think, forms of media outlets, you know, whether it's like TV channels or whether it's print media, they're owned by very few corporations who are hand in glove with the government, right? So the news channels that people watch on a daily basis, they are propagating the regime's view of things. In fact, there was an amazing kind of sting post operation called the Cobra sting post operation done in, I think it was 2018, where they went round and it was like an undercover investigation, and they found that so many of the media channels were, you know, ready to basically advertise, you know, the Hindutva agenda, the Hinduism agenda. And so they did a big revelation. But you see it all the time, right? You have, you know, channels like Republic TV who are very pro-government. And last week or 2 weeks ago, there was there's been the first clampdown on the YouTube channels, the independent YouTube channels as well. So I think we're going to see like an even greater silence. There'll be an attempt to get even those little small independent spaces that still exist, you know, places like the Wire and Article 14 and lots of independent like online sites, which are still doing amazing work. But they are they are really on threat, you know, both physically, like in terms of like living in India and continuing to do this work, but also just like being able to pursue it. Like their platforms are going to be, you know, are under threat with closure. Yeah.
So let's talk about your book, The Incarcerations. So it's about the arrest of 16 intellectuals, activists, lawyers, journalists. Why did you think that this situation, this wave of arrests, was so important and worth writing this book about?
It was a kind of bellwether for the collapse of democracy in India. It was the first time in Indian history that, you know, 16 people were picked up from all over the country who were not really connected to each other, who were from all professions, you know, as you said, you know, intellectuals, lawyers, poets, artists, human rights activists, trade unionists, were picked up and basically on completely, you know, alleged to have incited violence at a place which many of them had not heard about, said that they were waging a war against the Indian state and that they were plotting to assassinate the prime minister. And, you know, this immediately grabbed my attention, also because I knew many of them. I knew the work of many of them. They were colleagues. Some of them we'd hosted in at the London School of Economics. You know, three of them, I think, we'd hosted or tried to host as you know, giving keynote lectures. One of them was on the advisory board panel of a project I'd run on ERC, European Union Economic Research Council, you know, the European Research Council project on the underbelly of the Indian economic boom. You know, so one of them, Anantel Tunde, was an advisor to that project. So these were all people whose work I knew. And, you know, so there were like different motivations. Like one was, you know, when your colleagues are imprisoned and there is nobody really in India who can write a full-length book on their case and bring it to attention internationally. You know, you have this kind of responsibility. I was asked actually to write the book by the last editor, the editor of my last book, Night March. And he said, you know, we really, really need a book on this case and you're the person to write it. And will you consider? And so there was that kind of, you know, ethical kind of dimension to it, like the responsibility I felt. It could have been one of us. It could have been me or any of my colleagues if we were out in India, you know, incarcerated. And so that was one of the big things. But then, you know, the more I dived into this case, the more fascinating it became, because it was really a window onto the wider collapse of democracy in India. You know, so the kinds of things we've been talking about, like the collapse of the media, we haven't talked about, but the collapse of the judiciary. What does democracy actually mean on the ground? What should it mean? You know, it this case and the people incarcerated in it were a window into those much bigger issues in the world's largest democracy, right? So you see that when the police started flashing all these letters saying, oh, we found all these letters on their computers and these letters show that these guys are waging a war against the Indian state. Look, this one shows that they're trying to assassinate the prime minister. They flashed them to the press shortly after making the arrests, and incarcerating some of the BK16, these 16 intellectuals who have become known as BK16. They flashed them, to the press, and the press just like went all out with that. They just started declaring these guys as terrorists and running like entire news programs on the fact that, suddenly you now have these terrorists, they're called Naxalites. They use the term Naxalites, which is actually a revolutionary movement that's had a long-standing armed revolutionary insurgency that's had a more than 50-year history in India. And, they say, oh, now these like revolutionaries, they call them terrorists, the terrorists are no longer just in the forests of India. They're all in the cities. And, they call them urban Naxalites are now urban Naxalites in the cities, and beware, they look like they're really lovely. They're kind of carrying their cloth bags, and they're going to literary festivals. But in fact, they are these urban Naxalites, these terrorists. And, the media was kind of portraying this whole story of these professors and these human rights lawyers and these trade unionists, who had been doing this kind of very, very tough work of fighting for democracy on the ground. And, the more I worked on the book, the more I saw both the big story of the collapse of democracy in India and also the story of the fight for democracy on the ground, because all of these activists had in different ways been fighting for the economic, political, social rights and justice for India's three main minorities. So it's Adivasis, it's indigenous people, 100 million people. It's Dalits, so these are the previously untouchable castes at the bottom of the caste system who face oppression. So there's another 200 million people. And the Muslims, who are another 200 million people who have been basically made into second-class citizens in India. So through the story of these 16 intellectuals and writers and activists, I could tell the story of India's, the fight for democracy for India's three main minorities, and also the wider story of the collapse of democracy in the world's largest democracy. So I think, it was multiple things. And of course, these are just incredible stories, like the story of the BK, that their lives are so rich. And I think we have so much to learn from them. So that was another amazing thing about writing this book. And I guess the last thing is, looking at the techniques of how these incarcerations were made. So looking at, I ended up like diving deep into the case itself and how they got implicated in riots that they hadn't caused but had been caused by Modi supporters. How different kinds of weapons have been used in this case. How the judiciary has failed them. How cyber evidence has been implanted on their computers. So the use of cyber warfare and clamping down on democratic rights activists, told this like huge array of the story, the weapons of authoritarian regimes too. So that's what drove the writing of this book.
That was the first part of my conversation with Alpesh Shah. To listen to the rest of the conversation, you can sign up at patreon.com/crashcoursepod. Subscriptions start at £3 a month, or you can sign up for a 7-day free trial. That's patreon.com/crashcoursepod. Crash Course is produced and edited by Patrick Herdman, who also does the sound design.